Welcome to Conversations with Dr. Stephen Greer on the World Puja Network, and I would like to thank the people at the World Puja Network for hosting us here every 2 weeks to bring you an update on what we're doing with the OrionProject.org and the Disclosure Project. And I'm joined today by my long-term friend and assistant in all this work, Linda Willis. Thank you for being here with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. It's always a pleasure.
Great. Yes, and just as a note, Linda has just moved here to the Charlottesville, Virginia area, where she'll be working full-time with us to help with all these projects that are becoming more and more world-encircling, and we have many exciting things to report today. But I wanted to focus today's discussions on what we do when we go on these expeditions for the Center for the Study of Extraterrestrial Intelligence. You can see what we do at those at CSETI.org and CSETI.org. And these are events, we're about to have one out on the Barrier Islands, the Outer Banks of North Carolina, actually beginning next week. And we're going to have about 40 people with us on that expedition. And a key part of it is the understanding of the nature of how consciousness or mind interfaces with electromagnetic systems, communication systems, and the interstellar technologies. And one of the things that is really self-evident to anyone who thinks about it is that if you're an interstellar civilization, you're probably not using early 21st century Earth technology. And this statement is of such great obviousness that it is missed by many people, particularly scientists who will say, well, we're looking for these extraterrestrial civilizations with the spectra and the type of technologies we're using now, such as radio telescopes or microwave signals or what have you. And while certainly that is possible, in terms of a mature understanding of what's involved, if ET is here, and they are, and we have the evidence for that at disclosureproject.org, if you go to disclosureproject.org, you'll see irrefutable evidence of this. The question then becomes, if we're going to have a diplomatic contact with them, don't we need to expand our understanding to at least begin to cross over to their worldview? And by worldview, I mean universal understanding of science and consciousness. So science and consciousness is key here, and this is a whole area of study that many people listening to World Puja Network would be intimately familiar with, and is a big focus of the book Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, which is the story of how we have had all these experiences all over the world where we have been able to make contact. And one of the things that's interesting, back in the 1990s, after I had had many years of contact with these ETs, I began to collect stories from around the world where people had what are called close encounters of the fifth kind. And this is a term that I coined in 1990 for when humans deliberately set up an attempt to make contact with extraterrestrial spacecraft or occupants or civilization. And a close encounter of the fifth kind is very distinct from the other categories, which are really very passive. You know, the other ones are, you know, close encounter of the first kind is a sighting within a certain distance. A close encounter of the second kind is when there's some landing or physical trace, and there are over 4,000 of these. A close encounter of the third kind, of course, is when there is, from the movie that everyone has seen, that Steven Spielberg did, is when there is a sighting or an encounter with a being, an extraterrestrial life form. And a close encounter of the fourth kind is when someone has gone on board a craft. But this is different. A close encounter of the fifth kind is when someone or a group of people specifically attempt to set up a deliberate contact for interaction that's mutual and bilateral, as opposed to a passive event that's seen or what have you. And we started this project, the CE5 initiative, we call it, back in 1990. It's now 19 years old, and we have gone all over the world. And one of the core things that I found as I began to collect these experiences from other people, not just my own, was that often people would see one of these ET vehicles, extraterrestrial vehicles, and they would signal to it, and it would signal back. But also very frequently, I found in the reports of thousands of cases, people would have a thought, oh, I wish it would move to the right so I can see it better, and it would move to the right. And then they said, oh, I wish it would move down, and it would move down. And there was this mental thought connection to the craft which seemed inexplicable and impossible. Now, Dr. Richard Haynes at the NASA Ames Research actually helped collect a lot of these and came out with a book called CE5 back in the 1990s. And I was grateful that he did this work, because it illustrates the extent to which this has occurred all over the world. And so we formalized this into a research protocol, and the research protocol involves training people in consciousness so that they can understand that the mind within each of us is actually a universal resonance field through which coherent thought, kind of like if you look at a laser, it's coherent light. Anybody with physics training out there, it's not ordinary light like a flashbulb. It's actually coherent light, that thought that is emanating from a samadhi state, an expanded state of consciousness, that where you can then see remote places and then connect with very coherent thought, and as a guidance system, show them where you're located on the earth and what your intentions are, is an incredibly powerful technique for making contact. And this, of course, is a big part of the training, because many people do not have a very good training in meditation or in the ability to remote view, which is to see with consciousness distant places or events. And so we put this into a formal program, and actually you can get the meditation CDs as well as the CE5 training materials at the Disclosure Project website, which is disclosureproject.org. But what we do with these expeditions is that we train people to do this, and then we go out under the stars until, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning. Not so good for morning people, but they can just pretend they're going to Europe and get on a different time zone. But we have extraordinary experiences, and lately have been able to capture a great deal of electromagnetic and images and film experiences, some of which are up at csetti.org. So this is sort of as a way of introduction of the history behind what we're doing now and the kinds of experiences we're having. And for many people, of course, everyone listening to the World Pooja Network, if they're on this particular network, they're listening because they're certainly aware of spirituality, and they're certainly aware of higher states of consciousness. And in the sense that when we have an understanding that any civilization that is beyond our solar system and is light years away, which is the closest next star system, is quite a few light years away, in order to get here, you can't travel or communicate at speeds less than multiples of the speed of light. The speed of light is just way too slow. And so that's what is a simple fact that is irrefutable. And because of that, you then begin to have to study what I call the whole concept of extraterrestrials and the new cosmology, which is actually a chapter in my first book, Extraterrestrial Contact, The Evidence and Implications, where I talk about the fact that there is absolutely no way that we can understand interstellar civilizations unless we understand the nature of the awake cosmos, the awake being within ourselves, and how thought and consciousness interface with very advanced electromagnetic communication systems. So that's just in a way of introduction. Now, of course, Linda's been with me for now, 12 years, I guess?
12 years, yeah.
And has experienced this and seen a number of these things, and she may want to make some comments of her own on that.
Oh, well, we have seen so many incredible things, but in talking about communicating with the ETs through thought, we routinely have communications where, we will think to an object in the sky to show us if it's a satellite. A satellite will just continue on a straight trajectory. So we'll ask an object to show us if it's an ET craft, to do a zigzag or something. And if it is, they respond. And we've had just so many experiences with communicating with ETs. Some people who are really, really good remote viewers and see things, visualize things very clearly, actually go on board craft and see ET beings on the craft. And this happens quite often with a lot of people.
Well, you know, here in at our farm in Charlottesville, Virginia, in October, we had over a number of nights an object that set up in the southwest sky. You might recall, Linda.
Oh, yeah.
And it was signaling with us for an hour or two at a time. And when we would need to take a break, we had a night scope, a fourth-generation night scope hooked to a digital camera on this craft. And it, as soon as I would say, it's time for us to take a break, it would stop.
Right.
Now, no natural object or man-made object is going to do that. And it was literally as soon as the words would come out of my mouth. When we would return from a break and we would make circle and I would say, well, now let's begin again and begin our meditation, it would begin signaling again.
It was so tuned into us, yeah.
Yeah, it was absolutely unbelievable. And this happened multiple times. So what's interesting about that, of course, is there were 30 or 40 people who saw it, and we filmed it, but that it's become the ordinary. What sounds extraordinary to people, I guess, has become the new norm for C-SETI. And I think this is what's wonderful, is that I think the evolution of this is such that in order for us to be able to be interstellar people, we're going to have to come to a new norm. And the new norm is one where the preeminent science on Earth will be the study of consciousness and the development of higher states of consciousness, without which it is impossible to entertain being able to have a relationship with these other civilizations who are here and who are urgently wanting us to enter the state of spiritual maturity, the first sign of which, of course, is a peaceful world on this earth. But the second stage of which is a state of enlightenment where people understand that we have got this ability within us, each and every single person on the planet, to be awake, and that within the purity of that awake mind, the samadhi state, the state of nirvana, that every individual can become a universal ambassador. And that's why we call what we're doing ambassadors to the universe, because we are literally training people to be, although it is outside the avenues of the United Nations or the State Department or what have you, or the Foreign Service of another government, it is a global effort. We have people who are on our team now from Malaysia and from Japan and from Russia and from China and Australia and Latin America and all over Europe and every country you can imagine. And what we are finding is that these people go back to their countries and they continue to have these sort of extraordinary encounters that are initiated through understanding the protocols of higher states of consciousness, remote viewing, along with the other technologies we use. Now, we do also have high-powered laser systems we use. We have a radio frequency transmitters that we transmit some electronic tones that we have captured from some of our expeditions, one of which actually was provided to us by Colin Andrews, who had been with a BBC team in a crop circle when one of these strange tones came into the crop circle. And it was actually such a intense tone that it damaged two of the, back then they were beta cams, and did about $75,000, I'm told, in damage to these cameras. But they were able to record it, and it was an electromagnetic tone, and we have taken it and we use it to project out in the space. But since then, we have also had some amazing C-SETI tones that have come when we were, you may want to tell people just briefly, Linda, about what happened at Mount Shasta with the tones there.
Yeah, that was in 2005, and Dr. Greer was doing a guided meditation, And it was absolutely not coincidental. He paused for a few moments as he was speaking in the meditation, and during that quiet period when he paused, there was a sort of a trilling sound. It lasted about 2 seconds, and it appeared behind. Actually, I was sitting to the left of him, and it appeared about 4 or 5 people down to my left, kind of behind us. And it was a trilling tone, lasted about 2 seconds. It was very distinct, obvious. Most people heard it. And what was so interesting about the sound was the sound created a visual shape in our minds, and virtually all of us saw it as a string of pearls. I certainly saw it as a string of pearls, and most other people did as well.
Right. And in fact, virtually everyone there, we had 40 or 50 people there that year, and it was interesting because it was the sound created the form. And this is very Vedic. If you understand the Sanskrit concept, the Vedic concept of name and form, that actually the shape of something and the form of an object is preceded or has within it a tonality, a pure tonality, and that if you understand that well enough in a deep level of consciousness, you can actually materialize things from consciousness. And there are accounts of enlightened beings who have been able to materialize pieces of fruit or a ring or what have you. And the way that's done is by, from a deep level of consciousness, to initiate the tonality of that object and the visual of it, which is like the astral component, and then intend and manifest it into three-dimensional space-time. Well, this is very, very close, actually, how interstellar vehicles move through space. They are not going through wormholes, which is one of the popular theories. It's because they are actually resonantly shifting beyond the speed of light into something resembling an astral or etheric energy field, but then within that is a tonality. And so this ship, this was actually an extraterrestrial vehicle, was on site, and everyone heard this very distinct, complex tone, but saw, as clear as someone was putting an image in front of them, this sort of a connections of spheres, several spheres connected together like that, like a string of pearls. And it was really extraordinary. Luckily, Linda almost always records what I'm saying during one of these meditations. And so she had her recorder on. Even though we were out in the, of course, mountains up at Mount Shasta, we did capture some of it, and it's gotten analyzed and put together by one of our team members in Arizona, Charlie Baylog, who has been wonderful to help us with these things, and is a really great man and a very pure spirit. And we now have that, and we are using those as well to transmit back into space. And now, of course, the actual recording of it electronically with a man-made device is a faint, how can I say this? It's a faint shadow, in a sense, of what we experience, because this was a multi-dimensional tone. It's hard to explain. It was as if it was an omnidirectional effect. And it had this visual effect. These are sort of experiences we have that are very, very profound, and give us a great deal of understanding of how extraterrestrial civilizations are materializing from one point in space to another. And also that these things almost always happen when the group, even if it's 30 or 40 or 50 people sitting out under the stars, become highly coherent in a deep meditative state and begin to connect to that state, and then we will have these extraordinary things happen. And this is where I say primacy is in consciousness. Primacy of the CE5 awareness, of CE5 initiative, is in the state of samadhi, in the state of pure consciousness. And in that state, then all things are possible, because these extraterrestrial civilizations, they're looking for that for one simple reason. They know that in order for us to understand, begin at all to understand their paradigm of universality, of transporting and communicating across the vast distances of space, that we're going to have to begin to both experience personally and understand intellectually very thoroughly the interface of awareness and consciousness with the so-called etheric and astral field, but also the material world and our physical bodies and the earth herself, that all of this is a conscious being manifesting as a tree or an apple or a human body or a rock or a mountain. And the saying that all this is that is literally is true. And the experience of that state of unity consciousness and cosmic awareness that precedes it is really, most people view that as the end point in one's path. We view it as the beginning point. And the understanding and the experience of that is the beginning point of being an ambassador from Earth to these civilizations. And it's really a beautiful thing. And once people, enough people begin to have that level of experience as well as understanding, it's amazing how these extraterrestrial civilizations will come cooperate with the team and also manifest in a whole lot of different ways, whether it's with an object that is signaling and interacting with awareness and with our lasers or these tones or some other really unusual event. And
well, you know, what's really incredible about the trainings is that the ETs actively participate in training us. And so many times they appear in very subtle ways, or they do really unusual but very subtle things, and then they wait until we notice it. And then they'll like, for example, there will be an ET craft, a saucer-shaped craft that's just sort of, it looks like a mist in the distance, and it's very subtle. And as soon as we notice it, they actually will even like dim it down. And kind of to indicate to us that they know that we know that they know that we saw it.
Right.
And, I mean, remember the time at Joshua Tree when it was a moonless night and the sky was brightly illuminated. For as far as we could see, it was like there was a full moon and we were actually seeing our shadows on the ground. And we started commenting about it, and suddenly it was as if somebody flipped a switch and it got dark.
That's right, and it was this amazing, almost etheric light that everyone there saw. And we said, "Where is this light coming from?" We're sitting, and we realized, not coincidentally,
yeah,
it was actually, I saw the origin of it from a craft, and it was in Orion, in the Orion constellation up above us at the Joshua Tree. Joshua Tree, and this was they were waiting for us to acknowledge the presence and to pick up on the subtle cues. So it's very nuanced. Everyone is expecting, you know, let's go kick the tires of a extraterrestrial vehicle. And we have had some pretty spectacular full materializations of craft and beings. Actually, a couple years ago, we had four ET beings that appeared fully materialized outside the circle at Joshua Tree and was seen by the group. I think that what people have to understand, though, is that there are so many other ways in which communication happens, and all of it is sort of a highly, highly instructive of what they know we need to begin to understand, to understand how amazing and wondrous the cosmos is and all the ways that they can manifest around us. So, and, of course, people say, well, some of these things sound almost like something that an angelic being and what have you. And I said, well, yes, but angels don't have flying saucers or huge spacecraft that have to move through the sky, although there is certainly a relationship between the level of consciousness of these civilizations and other beings that are highly evolved that are not material. But when we're talking about these extraterrestrial civilizations, every one of them, the least developed amongst them, would still be at a level of very evolved cosmic awareness. And the reason for that is that they cannot even function through space unless that were so. This reminds me of the conversation I had with when I was meeting with the CIA director back in the 90s, Bill Clinton's first CIA director, about this issue. And they had become quite interested in what was happening because many people in the intelligence community and in government had heard that we had made contact with these vehicles over on the coast of near Pensacola, Florida, on the beach. And there were about, I guess, 30 or 40 people there for a weekend training I was doing. And we'll be doing some of these actually this year around the country that we are now setting up. I hope next time we're speaking with you, we can actually tell you what city we'll be doing this in. But it was a group of people, and it was just really a day-long sort of workshop and training, because I can't always spend an entire week wherever I go. And that evening, I took them out to this beach, a state beach there outside of Pensacola, Florida. And we set up the protocols, and then about 8, I think it was about 8:40, something like that, in the evening, we had four of these craft appear. Three of them made a perfect triangle after we signaled with our lights for them to make a triangle, and then they proceeded to signal with us. Now, the part of this that was really extraordinary is that they were bilocating on the in the part. We were sort of in a parking lot by the beach. They bilocated there astrally, and there were these beams moving around, and there were some women there who actually saw this. It was not like a ghost. It was a little more like a hologram, and they got so completely freaked out, they jumped in their trucks. They were in pickup trucks and raced back to town. It was rather hilarious, I thought, but of course, it was nothing frightening at all about it. I thought it was wonderful, but this ended up on the front page of the paper the next day. It was seen by so many people in the area. Not just people that I had taken out for this contact event. And, of course, subsequently, the former head of Army Intelligence heard about it and blah, blah, blah. So a year or so later, a year and a half later, I'm there, meeting with Bill Clinton's CIA director, discussing disclosure of this information, the technologies, all of this. And it was a very policy-wonkish meeting. I mean, the cover story was a dinner at this town home in the D.C. area, and this is very funny because I recount this story in my book, Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, which you can get at disclosureproject.org. But in it, I talk about how, the CIA director and I and this host was the only one who knew we were having this meeting, and the hostess did not know who was coming to dinner. And nor did the wife of the CIA director know who she would be meeting, meaning me. I mean, she knew she was going to be with her husband somewhere at dinner. So this is, of course, very typical of Washington, the spook world. And the guy who set it up, I just went along with this because that's how he wanted to do it. He wanted to be extremely quiet about it, which is okay. And but you can imagine the shock of the hostess who finds out that 2 hours before the meeting is to start, that she's going to be making dinner for the director of Central Intelligence and his wife and this expert on extraterrestrial contact who is coming. So at any rate, it is rather comical, I thought. So anyway, my wife and I went there, and most of the discussions were very much about the secrecy and why the President of the United States and this CIA director, who was fairly new, were being denied access to the files that deal with this and to the programs that deal with this. And I was explaining to them the illegal and rogue nature of the Majestic group that runs these programs. And it was very policy wonk oriented. But at some point during the dinner, because at this point we'd been there an hour or two, I don't know how long, and it was something like that, maybe 2 hours. And the wife of the CIA director, who had been the chief operating officer of the National Academy of Sciences, the most prestigious scientific organization in America, or one of the most, she was there, and it was the wife of the CIA director, Woolsey. And so Dr. Woolsey leaned in and said, "Well, I'd like to know, how are they communicating across these vast interstellar distances?" And of course, she was smart enough to know that I began to think to myself, oh boy, do I tell her the truth and lose all credibility as a scientist, or do I tell her something that sounds like something scientific that you would see on the National Geographic Channel by some, quote, UFO expert and maintain my credibility. And I decided then and there, and this is back, you know, in the early days of these projects, that I was going, if someone had the insight to ask the question, I was going to tell them the truth. So I said, well, Dr. Woolsey, you know, if you just take our own Milky Way galaxy, the galaxy that our sun and the Earth and our other planets and our solar system are part of, our one galaxy, which is an ordinary size galaxy, is about 100,000 light years across. Now, that's the distance a beam of light will cover in 100,000 years, going 186,000 miles every second. Is enormous volume of space. So I said 100,000 light years is our one galaxy. So let's say that in our nearby galactic neighborhood, the sun is here, and somewhere in our nearby galactic neighborhood within our galaxy, 1,000 light years away, which is only 1% of the way through the Milky Way galaxy, if you can visualize that, our one galaxy, of which there are billions, that there's another star system that has an advanced civilization that is visiting the Earth, because at this time in our evolution, we are needing some help and we are needing some guidance, and also need to be perhaps contained from becoming a threat to other civilizations at some point, since we're still murdering each other by the millions every year. And so here they are, and they're wanting to communicate from their home planet to their spacecraft at the Earth and back. And for them to say, hello, how are you today? And for the spacecraft at the Earth to say, fine, thank you very much. If they were using AT&T or Sprint or a radio signal like the SETI project fantasizes about, that would take 2,000 years. 1,000 years for the signal to get here, 1,000 years for the return. Now, 2,000 years for one simple conversation. It's the time since the birth of Christ, for heaven's sakes. And so I said to her, look, the speed of light is too slow, and when you cross over beyond the speed of light through resonant fields of electromagnetism, you cross into what the mystics used to call the etheric and astral, and also the realm of thought. And so that these civilizations actually have electronic devices, and we've seen these, and I actually know people who worked on them, where we have shot these craft down tragically, and they worked on these, that have very refined electronics that interface directly with thought, as long as it's from an expanded awareness and coherent. And this is an ordinary, like you and I would use our cell phone to call our parent, our mother on Mother's Day next month. This is how they communicate. This is very ordinary. And she looked at me, and this is, you know, the wife of the CIA director and the chief operating officer of the National Academy of Sciences, and I didn't know if she was going to just break out in laughter and think it was the most ridiculous thing she ever heard. But no, she leaned in and she said, you know, I thought it had to be something like that.
That's great. It was a
wonderful experience. And what that said to me is that even in the most hidebound circles of academia, so long as they don't talk about it in polite company, it's a private conversation, you see, people understand these concepts. This is not such a foreign idea, because people do get the concept that we are being visited, and any intelligent discussion about it immediately brings up this issue of, well, if they're here and they're communicating around the cosmos at multiples of light years away, they cannot be using anything as slow as the speed of light. They have to be using things. And so I developed a concept back in 1991 in a paper that ended up getting picked up by McDonnell Douglas and Boeing and Lockheed and the CIA director and some other folks. And it was talking about technology-assisted consciousness and consciousness-assisted technologies. And the technology-assisted consciousness would be where there is a device that assists the awareness in the transmission of thought or remote viewing and what have you. And a consciousness-assisted technology would be where you would actually interface with a device to cause it to do something. and it flows both ways. And these civilizations that are visiting here have very well-developed sciences and technologies that interface with consciousness and thought at that level of precision. And this is what people have to understand. This is the first thing they have to understand when they're going to come out to one of these expeditions, which, you know, you are all invited to do this at some point, or to perhaps come to one of these shorter workshops that we'll be putting up on our website soon. We're working right now to develop those. And that is that there is absolutely no way you're going to be able to understand, if you're just going to sit out and look at the night sky and think that it's going to be like a Boeing 747. It may look like that initially, but what you're dealing with, if it's really not a man-made anti-gravity craft, which they do exist, and we can distinguish those very quickly, if it's actually an extraterrestrial vehicle, you know, get your cosmic boots on, because we're really on for a ride now, my friends, because these civilizations in no way have to come down to the level of 20th century and early 21st century technology, and they don't. And what we find very quickly is that they're expecting us to arise to an understanding of what it is that they have, and this is the first step. It isn't the end of the process. It's the beginning of the process, is to have this understanding and then to be trained in the development of higher states of consciousness and meditation and remote viewing and then remote vectoring. And by remote vectoring, I mean when you are in this expanded state of consciousness, you actually then see where these extraterrestrial vehicles are, lock onto their telecommunication systems that interface with coherent thought and awareness and image, and show them where you're located. So if you're listening in Montana right now, you can do that and vector them in. Now, it isn't as if they're puppets on a string and they don't show up instantly, and they don't always show up because of it's not like they don't have anything else they're doing. But the invitation can be made. And if it's made in a spirit of pure-heartedness, of peace, of universal awareness, you'll be surprised how many times contact will be occurring. So that is what we train people to do. And, of course, when you do this for an entire week, it's really a wonderful experience for a group, and that's what we'll be doing next week out on the beautiful ocean of the Outer Banks, and along with the Atlantic bottlenose dolphins who come alongside us all the time. And we were there the last couple of years, and we've had these big schools of dolphins that come along, and it's just an amazing experience. That expedition is full. There's no more room in that one, but we'll be doing the same thing in Colorado in June. And we'll go up on the Sacred Mountain of the East at Blanca Peak, and as well as be in the San Luis Valley, where there's a lot. It's called the Mysterious Valley for a reason. There are so many of these things over the years that have happened there. So we take an expedition and training there every year to Colorado, and then we will also be up at Mount Shasta over at the end of August this year. And then we'll be in Joshua Tree, where we've had so many amazing things happen in November. So those are planned, and we're also going to be coming to various cities to give presentations and then do day-long workshops and just one-day expeditions for people who can't make it to these longer week-long events. So you can find out about all those at csetti.org and disclosureproject.org.
Right, they're going to be a taste of what we do for a whole week, and we have had great success even in just one night of doing this kind of work with groups.
Oh yeah, well, I can honestly say that I cannot remember a time where we have done this where we have not had some kind of sighting and contact and experience that's been amazing. And even if it has been, like I mentioned, even from the early days in Florida where we did this one day workshop and then went out that evening, and we had this event that ended up being on the front pages of the paper, but only that, but we had these craft that appeared and then these beings that were moving around in the parking lot in the etheric sort of almost like a hologram that was sensed by not everyone, but quite a few of the people felt it and then saw some of it. And most of the people were okay with it. There were a couple people who I think were really thought that this was what they call in the UFO subculture, quote, a sky watch, where you just passively watch the sky and see if something happens. And if it does, it's at some distance. This is a big order of magnitude past that, because this is where we're actually inviting them to make contact. And in fact, they do. And on virtually every one of these week-long expeditions, we've actually had at least one, if not most of the people in the group at some point, physically touched at some point by an ET being that appears very quickly and touches them.
And it's just like a person touched you. You swear that, you know, I mean, when it's happened to me, I'll look behind me and think, you know, that someone's trying to get my attention and there will be no one there that I could see.
Right.
That's very distinct.
And a lot of people say, well, why don't they just fully materialize and stay for a prolonged period? And I say, well, maybe they're trying to teach us some other things, or for security reasons. One of the things that has become very clear is that as we've gone from the 50s to the 90s to 2009, these rogue military programs have really become insanely violent, and with increasingly sophisticated technologies have targeted these extraterrestrial spacecraft when they're fully materialized. And this is why one of the things we always ask is that they do whatever is safe and appropriate for that time and place. We never try it. It's a very mutual, peaceful, non-insistent process. It isn't this thing, damn it, you better come, I'm here and I'm getting cold and I'm outside, or that kind of thing. It's very much whatever, whatever way they can materialize or manifest or not materialize and do something else, we are aware of it and we will be appreciative of it and we will be transmitting the same back, because we realize that we're not just bags of bones and physical bodies, that we also have our body of light. We also have within us the spark of our individuality, and then within that, the conscious light that is the single light of awareness. And the reason remote viewing works is because we are awake all the time. Even when we're sleeping, that seed or essence of the mind is there, and you are omnipresent within that mind, that there is, as Erwin Schrödinger, who was the father of modern particle wave theory and later became quantum mechanics, said back in the early part of the 1900s, he said, the total number of minds in the universe is one, and that is, it is a singularity. And this has actually been proven scientifically, and it is a fact. And once you understand that about the nature of the fact that you're an awake being, then you can realize that you are, in fact, always omnipresent. It's a matter of making the mind empty and pure of all of its distractions and going into a deep and silent place within the awareness. And you can then see any place and communicate with any being, as well as see into the future or the past. And although the future is something that is a little less determined because of everything that is happening in the sphere of free will, affects the outcome. And this is why when I tell people, when you get off the timeline of now, not so much for the past is pretty much set, not always, but pretty much set, but when you're looking into anything off the timeline of now into the future, you can only speak of probable futures if you're going to be honest. And this is why psychics and people like that say XYZ is going to happen on X date, the reason they're almost always wrong is that the fact that they saw that and said that is something that creates a serious problem in terms of it actually being fulfilled in quite that literal way. And that is, the actions and thoughts that result from such an observation do affect the event itself. And this is why when you're talking about the future, you have to think of probable futures. But we do that as well. We train people. For example, one of the assignments that I give to people each afternoon and evening is that in dream time and also during the meditation in the afternoon is to go into this deep meditation and then move off of the timeline of the now and to remote view what would happen that night or what's going to be happening that week. so that people begin to get a sense and a feel to prepare themselves. And then as we gather in a circle, and we ask everyone to share that without any ego attachment, just put it out there as if it belongs to everyone once the words are spoken. And it's amazing how many people will start at the beginning of an evening and say, well, you know, I did the meditation and I went into this deep state of consciousness and I saw whatever, a big sphere appearing in the zenith at around 10:30. And sure enough, something like that will in fact happen. So that everyone will see. So what's interesting is that you can do this also to begin to be what I call a seer, where you can see and get the sense of things that are possible into the future. But again, a little bit of humility requires that one speak of it in terms of not a certainty, but it's a possible future or a probable future. And some are more probable than others when you get what I call a hit, this kind of a clear hit. And there's a certain quality to that. And one of the things about this training program for remote viewing and meditation and contact that we do that's very self-reinforcing is that once you do it and you get an accurate perception and then the event happens, it then increases your confidence that it's possible and that you can do it. And with that increased hope and confidence and positivity, it creates a positive feedback loop where you then can do it more and more and more. And this is true of everything in our lives. You know, if you sit around saying, oh, I can't do it, and poor little me, and I can't do this, and I can't do that, well, you're not. You're going to fail at everything you try to do. If the power of positive thinking really is a reality and has been studied, and that if you then begin to have some experience that indicates this is possible, and you give that amount of positive energy to it, in fact, it will be possible. And so this is another part of the dynamic in the training that people have to understand, is that one has to step into this sort of flow of awareness and know that it's possible. And when you know it's possible, it will be. And once it begins to happen, then there's this exponential growth curve that happens because you realize, my God, this is really very simple. And it is. It's an amazingly simple thing to do. The reason it is, and everyone makes it very complicated, the reason it's very simple is that everyone listening right now is awake. And you can train, and this is what we train people to do, is to be awake and just aware of the awareness, and then deeply aware of the awareness, and then awaken within that silent mind, the aspect of the unbounded consciousness that's folded within us, and then begin to see remote places and if necessary, deep space or another planet, and connect to these civilizations, and then turn it around to not just a remote viewing that's passive, but an active vector. And we train people to then actively vector, show how to get from where you're sensing in space you are right into the Earth, right into where the site is that our contact team is operating. And it's a very specific protocol from a very coherent level of thought and deep consciousness. And this is really what is the central thing that we share and teach over the course of the week. And it's a wonderful experience that we guide people through. And interestingly, you know, about a year and a half ago, I did one of these up in Canada and in Bromont in Quebec. And some of the people who were there actually took it upon themselves after, and this was just one of these weekend retreats, to try and do this on their own. So they went up to Lac Edouard, which is in the northern Quebec, going north of Montreal, and they immediately had an amazing contact, very material, full craft overhead. And one of the people who was there began to have this amazing effect. He had this sort of a cosmic consciousness experience in contact with one of the beings. And then when he would be in a darkened room, he would see that there was like a star chart of lights on his skin. It was beautiful. And we call him our star guy. He's quite shy and embarrassed about it. But, you know, if you take him into a dark room and put a black light, you'll see these specific star fields that have appeared on him. It's just amazing the things that are happening. And this was a group that continued to do this from just a weekend training. And so I tell people that, you know, it isn't as if this is this is the birthright of every human being, to be awake and to be a child of the cosmos. And that's how we need to, if we view ourselves as children of the cosmos and know that we are, then we will be. And that's so much of what this is about.
You know, I think one of the keys to this is that most people don't even consider that we have these capabilities, so we don't even think about it. And suddenly when, you know, on these trainings, when it's brought to our knowledge that we can do remote viewing, or that we can train ourselves to see subtle things which would appear to be invisible to most people who aren't trained to look for them, you're just amazed and delighted at these new capabilities that you have. And then it's really empowering when you go forward into life, because you can use these things in your daily life as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And in fact, you know, I tell a few stories. Those of you who've gotten Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, I tell some stories of, you know, being in the emergency department. You know, I'm a trauma doctor, and it has a lot of practical applications. There was a man that came in who had it was flu season, and he came in complaining that he had the flu. And the nurses put him in a regular medical room, and he was, you know, he'd been nauseated and fever and chills and, you know, the usual, how you feel when you have the flu. And I walked into the room, and he had no other neurological complaints at all, but I looked at him, and I immediately saw or felt, and this is, people say, you're like a golden retriever, because golden retrievers are trained to sense things like this. But I looked at this man, and I said, my God, he's got a brain tumor. And I examined him, and he had no findings of a brain tumor, you know, like one pupil bigger than the other or any neurological deficits or anything. But I know what I knew, and it was a clear remote view. And I turned to the nurse, and I said, I need a stat CAT scan of the head, CT scan of the head. And the nurse said, well, Dr. Greer, she was from North Carolina, said, Dr. Greer, he's only got the flu. And I said, just do it. Don't, you know, just and the nice thing about that is that, you know, if we'd had to go through a HMO or something, it would have been denied. So he went and got the CAT scan. I explained to him and the family, this is a 26-year-old man with two children and his wife, and I said, I just want to check something to be sure, and, you know, don't worry. Sure enough, he had this enormous brain tumor, and it was a very bizarre distribution. It wasn't affecting anything neurological, except it had gotten so big that it was, and its distribution, it was pushing the brain stem down through the foramen magnum, the opening where the brain stem is, and it was pressing on the areas of the brain stem and midbrain that control temperature, nausea and vomiting, all of that. So all of his symptoms were from this thing and not from the flu, but it was a very, what we call an occult tumor, very hidden tumor that he had had no symptoms from. Now, it was at a point that if I had just given him flu medicine and sent him home, he very well probably would have had seizures and passed away very shortly. So he emergently we airlifted him, and he went to a specialty location and had neurosurgery, and I kept seeing him for a few years later, and he was doing fine. And I say to people, this neurosurgeon called me up, and he said, why did you even get a CAT scan? With this guy's presentation, I wouldn't have bothered. I would have thought he had the flu or something. And I said, well, I just had a hunch. Because in medical circles, it's not polite to say, or we're at a point in our civilization that's so materialistic that you're not supposed to say, well, gee, you know, I actually saw with my inner vision that this man had a brain tumor. And based on that, I got a CAT scan, and sure enough, it saved his life. But what's interesting is that as I tell this story sometimes to other physicians, I find that a lot of doctors have had those experiences, but our society has beat the heck out of us to the point that people don't feel okay sharing this sort of thing. And I think it's time that we say, look, it's okay to share the fact that we're not only material, physical beings, we're also spiritual beings, and we have these capabilities. And as Linda mentioned, acknowledging that and developing it in your life can save someone's life, or can improve your life in many other ways besides just becoming an ambassador to the cosmos. And so this is just one example of many that happened over the course of my medical career that I'm convinced that had I not been open to the power of this divine state of mind, there would be people dead today and who would not have been able to be saved. So it's a very interesting. I've also spoken to pilots, both airline and fighter pilots, who have had similar experiences where they have been able to remote view an event that's about to happen and anticipate it, and it has saved the plane or saved their lives. And so, you know, this actually happens a lot in what are called mission-critical professions, like emergency medicine and pilots and what have you. And it's not often talked about, and it's a shame that our society doesn't, because this is a whole aspect of ourselves that is really, really important to take out, to let come out and develop, that we have suppressed, that our society, our educational system and everything has really made it so it's not okay to talk about these things. And we need to make it okay again. And when we're talking about communicating with these civilizations who are interstellar, if they're advanced, my friends, enough to go through interstellar distances at multiples of the speed of light, believe me, this is their normal overall paradigm. This is their new norm. And so my suggestion is that this should be our new norm, is owning cosmic awareness and the ability to be a seer and to remote view and to make contact and to create universal peace on this planet, because this is the time for it.
That's right. It's starting to happen.
Oh, it's very much happening, yes. Oh, boy. More than I can say right now, because I will just say that this week has been extraordinary. In the past week, there are some things that are happening, both in Washington and in some other foreign capitals, where there is a huge breakthrough happening with bringing this information to the world and making contact, and the world is really going to go through an amazing transformation over the next coming months and few years. So we need all of your prayers for that, and we appreciate it. And also, the OrionProject.org has some scientists we're working with now that hold great promise, a number of teams, not just one, about four teams of people. And we have to keep this in hope and prayer that one of them will emerge through soon with the technology, so that we can begin a new civilization and lift the burden from Gaia, from the Earth, that we have placed on her. Because one of the reasons the ETs have taken such a strong interest in the Earth since World War II is that they know how much the nuclear weapons and the radiation and the chemicals and the pollution from the way we derive energy from coal and oil is damaging the nervous system and the water and the circulatory system and everything of this beautiful planet. And, you know, this planet is here to be the womb of the evolution of intelligent life into God consciousness for hundreds of thousands of years. And it's really not nice that the generation currently living on this planet is damaging so much of the Earth and using up so much of the Earth so unwisely. So it's really important that we, in compassion, develop these sciences and have the courage to stand up against the petro-Nazis to allow these new sciences out to benefit the world. And we can do this in a nonviolent way, the way Gandhi did. And we must do it, not only to make contact peacefully, but to let the truth be known about the way that Earth and humanity can live harmoniously together for hundreds of thousands of years in a high-tech society. And this is really what both the Disclosure Project and CSETI and the OrionProject.org are all about. And it's all part and parcel of an initiative. And I want to thank everyone at the World Puja Network for having supported us all these for the last year or so, because we have been making great progress. And without your support and interest, it would not have been possible. And I also would like to thank Linda Willits, who has spent 12 years of dedicated service helping us do this. She's been there in thick and thin and through all kinds of things. And thank you, Linda, for all of your help.
Oh, you're absolutely welcome.
Well, I think this wraps it up for this hour. I'd like to thank the folks at the World Puja Network for hosting us. You've been listening to Conversations with Dr. Stephen Greer, and we'll be with you again in a couple of weeks for some updates on the Orion Project's technology teams and their development. And until then, stay centered and be in cosmic awareness, and know that our time of universal peace on Earth is arriving. Thank you, and God bless.